Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Yeah. Today we're diving into a book that really feels incredibly timely, maybe even urgent. Timothy Snyder's On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century.
It really does feel urgent, and you can tell Snyder intended it that way. It's not, you know, just another history book. It's presented almost like a field guide.
A field guide, yeah.
His goal seems to be moving past pure academic discussion to offer something practical, something actionable for, well, for citizens everywhere who might be seeing authoritarian trends returning.
And it really cuts straight to the core, doesn't it? The central idea is that democracy isn't like the default setting. It's actually quite fragile.
Deeply fragile. It needs constant conscious effort from people to keep it going.
Which puts the focus squarely on individual responsibility, not just waiting for leaders to fix things.
Exactly. It's a call to action, basically saying, look, the catastrophes of the 20th century, fascism, communism, they left patterns. We can learn to recognize the signs.
Okay, so before we get into the lessons themselves, let's talk about the author. Who is Timothy Snyder? Why him?
Right. Well, he's the Richard C. Levin Professor of History at Yale. His specialty is Eastern European history, modern totalitarianism. So think the Holocaust, Stalinism.
Heavy stuff.
Extremely heavy stuff. He's looked deeply into how states commit mass violence, the mechanics of it all.
But what makes his perspective feel so relevant now?
I think it's his focus on what he calls the Bloodlands, that region between Hitler's Germany and Stalin's Soviet Union, where just unimaginable violence occurred. He understands how societies actually fall apart, like on the ground level.
And he's seen the flip side too, right? The attempts at democracy after the Cold War.
Precisely. He watched the transitions after 1989, but maybe more importantly, he's been watching the democratic backsliding happening more recently. Places like Hungary, Poland, he started seeing familiar signs.
Ah, okay. So he's connecting the historical dots to the present day.
Yes. He's taking all that deep, rigorous historical knowledge and essentially translating it into a kind of citizen's manual, saying, hey, these things I studied from the 1930s, I'm seeing echoes of them now.
Which brings us right to the book's main argument, this idea about the gradual nature of tyranny.
Yeah, the gradualism. It's not usually a sudden overnight coup like in the movies.
Right.
It's more often a series of small steps, incremental changes. Sometimes boring procedural stuff that slowly erodes institutions and just wears down people's will to resist.
And the book lays out these 20 lessons drawn from that 20th century European experience.
20 concise lessons. And they cover a lot of ground, from big ideas like how language gets manipulated, you know, post-truth politics, to really practical things like professional ethics or even just how we interact with each other day to day.
What I found really sort of empowering about it is how it shifts the lens away from just watching the big political figures.
Yes. Snyder keeps bringing it back to ordinary people. He argues it's the choices made by judges, journalists, doctors, regular citizens. That's what ultimately determines whether democracy holds or folds. History gives us the patterns, he says, to guide how we respond.
Okay, let's get into some of those specific lessons. They are really memorable. Lesson one, do not obey in advance. That one sounds almost counterintuitive.
It does, but it's crucial. He calls it anticipatory obedience. It's this phenomenon where people start adjusting their behavior, censoring themselves, before the new rules or the new regime even explicitly demands it.
Why do people do that? Is it just, like, trying to stay out of trouble, self-preservation?
Partly, yes. It feels like the safe thing to do, right? Keep your head down. But Snyder shows how this actually accelerates the authoritarian takeover.
How so?
Think about Austria in 1938, just before the Anschluss. Many Austrians started acting like Nazis, adopting the norms, before Germany formally annexed the country.
Right.
That voluntary compliance sends a powerful signal to the regime. You don't even need to force us. We'll do it ourselves. It basically hands them power on a platter.
So the lesson is, make them exert force. Don't make it easy for them.
Exactly. Force them to show their hand. Don't normalize the abnormal for them. Make them spend the effort to actually impose control. It's a form of resistance in itself.
That's a really interesting internal shift.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, moving from the personal to the professional. Lesson five, remember professional ethics. Why is this so important?
Well, think about how a tyranny actually functions day to day. It needs bureaucrats. It needs professionals to make the system work.
Like lawyers and judges.
Lawyers to twist laws, judges to rubber stamp unjust decisions, doctors to participate in or enable state-sponsored harm. You need compliant professionals. Snyder points to the chilling examples of Nazi doctors and lawyers who just abandon their oaths.
So upholding your professional code, whether you're a teacher, a journalist, an engineer, whatever, that's not just personal integrity. It's a form of, like, systemic defense.
Absolutely. It's a crucial line of resistance. If enough professionals refuse to compromise their ethics, the machinery of oppression can actually seize up. It makes the institutions themselves harder to corrupt.
It shifts the battleground, in a way.
It does. It makes the courtroom, the hospital, the newsroom, the classroom sites of potential resistance. It's often quiet, this ethical defense, but vital.
Okay, now let's link lessons 9 and 10 because they feel incredibly relevant right now.
Huh?
Be kind to our language and believe in truth. Snyder is really direct here. He says, to abandon facts is to abandon freedom.
Yeah, he doesn't pull any punches on that one. This gets right to the heart of, well, what people call post-truth politics.
How does language fit in?
Authoritarian regimes deliberately degrade language. They simplify everything down to slogans, repeat them endlessly, strip out nuance and complexity. Why? Because it makes critical thinking harder.
Right. If everything is just a soundbite, you can't have a real debate about policy.
Exactly. Accountability becomes impossible if you can't even agree on basic facts or use precise language to describe problems. It just dissolves into shouting matches or, worse, apathy.
It's like that idea from Victor Klemperer, the guy who studied Nazi language.
Yes. Klemperer showed how the Third Reich didn't just use propaganda. It fundamentally corrupted the German language itself, changing the meaning of words, limiting thought. Once they control the language, they control how you can even think.
So fighting for clear language, for verifiable facts, for a shared reality, that's not some academic exercise.
No, Snyder argues it's the absolute front line in defending freedom. If we give up on truth, we've given up on the foundation of democracy.
Okay, let's switch gears slightly. Lessons 12 and 13 seem almost simple. Make eye contact and small talk and practice corporeal politics. What's going on there?
It sounds basic, but it pushes back against another key tactic of tyranny, isolation.
Ah, making people feel alone.
Right, atomizing society. If people are suspicious of their neighbors, if they feel disconnected and alone, they're much easier to control. Fear thrives in isolation.
So, making eye contact, having small talk with the shopkeeper, that's actively rebuilding social trust.
Yes. It's those small, everyday interactions that weave the social fabric back together. A community where people know and trust each other, even a little bit, is harder to intimidate.
And corporeal politics, what does that mean? Not just online stuff.
Exactly. It means physically showing up, being present in public spaces with other people, going to a town hall meeting, joining a peaceful protest, even just gathering in a park.
So getting off the internet and into the real world.
Pretty much. Your physical presence alongside others demonstrates solidarity. It breaks the illusion that you're alone. It reclaims public space and makes resistance visible, tangible. It's a counterweight to purely digital activism.
Okay, one more specific lesson. And this one uses a word that's really loaded today. Lesson 19. Be a patriot. How does Snyder use that word? Because it often gets confused with nationalism.
That distinction is absolutely crucial for him. He defines patriotism very specifically. For Snyder, patriotism is loyalty to a country's democratic principles and universal values. It's about loving your country enough to hold it accountable to its own highest ideals, like its constitution or human rights.
So a patriot might be critical of their government precisely because they love their country's ideals.
Exactly. Patriotism involves wanting your country to be better, to live up to its promises. Nationalism, on the other hand.
That's different.
Very different. Nationalism, he argues, is usually about loyalty to blood, soil, or a specific group, often defined by excluding others. It demands blind obedience and often justifies anything done in the name of the nation, regardless of principles.
So he's reclaiming patriotism as a democratic concept.
Yes, as a tool for defending those core democratic values against nationalist erosion. It's a really important reframing.
Okay, stepping back from the individual lessons now. If you had to pull out, say, three big overarching themes from this whole deep dive, what would they be?
All right. First, definitely the power of individual agency. That's the bedrock. The book hammers home that history isn't predetermined. What ordinary people choose to do or not do really matters. It makes you, the listener, see yourself as part of the story, not just watching it unfold.
Yeah, that comes through loud and clear. What else?
Second, I'd say the gradualism of tyranny. We need to be alert not just for the big dramatic moments, but for the slow, creeping erosion of norms, institutions, checks, and balances.
Like changing election laws or weakening courts, things that might seem like just politics as usual.
Exactly. Those seemingly small, technical changes can be how democracies are dismantled from within. Think about Hungary under Orban. It wasn't a military coup. It was a long series of procedural changes that concentrated power. It's a process.
Okay, agency gradualism. One more.
The third has to be the interdependence of truth and democracy. We touched on this with the language lesson. You simply cannot have a functioning democracy without some shared basis in reality.
Because without facts?
Without facts, you can't have reasoned debate, you can't hold power accountable, you can't make informed choices. Post-truth isn't just confusing, it actively undermines the entire democratic project. It's foundational.
Snyder really does have a way with words, though. He distills these huge historical ideas into these really punchy, memorable lines.
He really does. They stick with you because they pack so much observation into just a few words.
Like, most of the power of authoritarianism is freely given. Boom! Right there.
Instantly shifts the focus, doesn't it? It says resistance starts by simply not volunteering your compliance.
We're the one we mentioned. Post-truth is pre-fascism. That's stark.
It's a direct warning. He's saying this breakdown of shared reality we're experiencing isn't just some cultural quirk. It's laying the groundwork for something much darker. Defending facts becomes defending freedom itself.
And one more about doing, not just feeling. Life is political, not because the world cares about how you feel, but because the world reacts to what you do.
Yeah, that cuts through any idea that just having the right opinions is enough. It demands action.
So, thinking about action. If this is a manual, what are some concrete things you, listening now, could actually do tomorrow, based on these lessons?
Well, on a personal level, it starts with resisting those simplistic slogans. Seek out nuance, read more deeply, and crucially, support actual investigative journalism.
You mean, like, pay for news subscriptions?
Yes,
yeah.
Pay for it. Quality journalism costs money, and it's one of the last big institutional checks we have against misinformation and power grabs. Consider it an investment in democracy.
Makes sense. What about, like, in your community?
Get involved locally. Strengthen civil society. That could mean joining an independent group, showing up at local meetings, and definitely vote in local elections.
Why local specifically?
Because authoritarians often start by capturing institutions from the bottom up: school boards, local courts, election boards. These seem small, but they're vital. Defending them is practicing that corporeal politics locally.
Right. But what about the big crisis, the unthinkable moment Snyder talks about?
Yes. Lesson 18. Be calm when the unthinkable arrives. The point of a manufactured crisis, like a Reichstag fire moment, is often to induce panic.
To make people demand a strong leader to save them.
Exactly. To make them trade freedom for the illusion of security. So, staying calm, thinking clearly, applying principles, even under pressure that itself is a powerful act of resistance. Don't panic.
Wow. Okay, so wrapping up, this book offers hope. But it's not a passive kind of hope, is it?
Not at all. It's a demanding hope. It's grounded in history, showing that, yes, democracies can fail, especially when citizens become complacent. But it also shows they thrive when people understand their power and their responsibility to act. That history of resistance is there.
And that final lesson, number 20, be as courageous as you can. It really leaves you with a challenge.
It does. It's a reminder that sometimes defending these principles might require real courage, maybe even personal risk.
Yeah.
But it also implies you're not alone when you do it. You're joining a long line of people who stood up before.
A powerful thought to end on.
Indeed.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker. Another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.